Today is Friday, April 19th, 2024. My name's Harold Topper, and I'll be reading from today's editions of the New York Times, Stanford Advocate, and Norwalk Hour. Leading article on the New York Times website: Israel strikes Iran, but scope of attack appears limited. Iranian officials reported blasts overnight at a military base near the city of Isfahan. Israel had vowed retaliation for Iran's attack last weekend, but muted initial reaction in both countries suggested they wanted to ease the tensions. Here are the latest developments. The Israeli military struck Iran early on Friday, according to two Israeli and three Iranian officials, in what appeared to be Israel's first military response to Iran's attack last weekend, but one whose scope, at least initially, appeared to be limited. The Israeli officials said that a strike had hit a military airbase near the city of Isfahan in central Iran. Initial reaction in both Israel and Iran was muted, with news media in both countries appearing to play down the attack in what analysts said was a sign that the rivals were seeking to de-escalate tensions. For nearly a week, world leaders have urged Israel and Iran to avoid sparking a broader war in the region. The Israeli military declined to comment. A senior U.S. official said that Israel had notified the United States through multiple channels shortly before the attack. All the officials spoke on condition of anonymity because they were not authorized to discuss the matter publicly. The explosions came less than a week after Iran fired more than 300 missiles and drones at Israel, nearly all of which were shot down, in response to an April 1st strike on an Israeli diplomatic compound in Syria that killed seven Iranian officials. That attack brought the decades-long shadow war between Israel and Iran, waged on land, at sea, in air, and in cyberspace, more clearly into the open. Here's what else to know. Israeli leaders came close to ordering widespread strikes in Iran on the night Iran attacked, officials said. But after Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu spoke with President Biden, and because the damage was limited, the War Cabinet postponed a decision. Mr. Biden and other world leaders urged Israel for days not to retaliate in a way that would inflame a wider Middle East war while it fights on two other fronts, against Hamas in Gaza and Hezbollah in Lebanon, both allies of Iran. The Iranian officials said that the attack on Friday was carried out by small drones, possibly launched from inside Iran. They said that a separate group of small drones was shot down in the Tabriz region, roughly 500 miles north of Isfahan. Iranian news agencies reported that nuclear facilities in Isfahan had not been hit. President Ibrahim Raisi of Iran had warned that, quote, the tiniest act of aggression, end quote, on his country's soil would draw a response. But in the hours after Israel's strike, there have been no public calls for retribution by Iranian officials. World leaders call for de-escalation after Israel's strike in Iran. World leaders on Friday urged Israel and Iran to de-escalate tensions after Israel struck an Iranian military base, the latest salvo in a cycle of retaliation that has raised fears of a broader war in recent weeks. Prime Minister Rishi Sunak of Britain, whose military participated in defending Israel last weekend against Iran's missile and drone attack, told reporters, "Significant escalation is not in anyone's interests. What we want to see is calm heads prevail across the region." Ursula von der Leyen, the president of the European Commission, the European Union's executive arm, told reporters during a visit to China, "It is absolutely essential that the region remain stable and that all sides refrain from further action." Italy's foreign minister, Antonio Tajani, said the group of seven nations, which includes Britain, Canada, France, Germany, Italy, Japan, and the United States, had changed the agenda of its meeting Friday on the resort island of Capri to, quote, address the Iran issue and put priority attention on the Middle East, end quote. The political goal of the G7 is de-escalation, Mr. Tajani said. The government of Jordan, which has been criticized in the Arab world for playing a role in intercepting Iran's attack last weekend, issued an especially pointed plea. Israeli-Iranian retaliations must end, Ayman Safadi, Jordan's foreign minister, said on Friday. He urged the international community to turn its attention back to Gaza, where 6 months of Israel's bombardment and ground invasion have killed over 33,000 people and led to extreme hunger in parts of the territory. The inhumane war on Gaza must end now, Mr. Safadi said. The focus of the world must remain on ending the catastrophic aggression on Gaza. Moving now to the Norwalk Hour. Developers break ground on controversial 77-unit Mill Pond development in East Norwalk. Byline Catherine Lucci, Dateline Norwalk. Behind the green fence off Cemetery Street, a new 77-unit mixed-use development overlooking Mill Pond is underway despite opposition. Approved over a year ago by Norwalk's Planning and Zoning, the development at 1 Cemetery Street, also known as Mill Pond, was met with fierce opposition from hundreds of East Norwalk residents who were upset by the scale of the project. Organized by the East Norwalk Neighborhood Association, a petition to stop the development gained 777 signatures and raised over $8,000 on GoFundMe for legal assistance. Located next to Mill Pond, environmental concerns were another issue for residents along with the project's size. Despite the public opposition, the project was approved under a special permit and is now breaking ground. Attempts to reach the developers were unsuccessful. The site was occupied by a small building that was formerly a Wells Fargo bank. Now demolished, crews are removing the parking lot to make way for development. When complete, the Mill Pond development will hold 77 apartments, retail and office space, an outdoor amenity space near the pond. Unit types range from 1 and 2 bedroom units to 3 and 4 bedroom units with second story loft space. Parking will be located under and outside the development. Next to the main building will be a small 2-story building with office space on the ground level and 3 3-bedroom units on the second floor. While spanning nearly the entire front of the property, the main building's facade will be broken up to appear as several connected buildings. On the corner of East Avenue and Cemetery Street will be 2,890 square feet of ground floor retail space with street access. This project is under an incentive system that rewards developers for implementing sustainable features or public amenities. Some of the sustainable features Mill Pond will include are a solar roof, pollinator habitats, and public waterfront access. Located down the street from the East Norwalk train station, the location is ideal for train commuters. To better accommodate pedestrians, bikers, and cars, the developer proposed making the 2-lane Cemetery Street 1 lane in front of Mill Pond. The space from the 2nd lane will be used for parallel parking spaces and a bike lane. The new traffic pattern was a key factor in residents' opposition, who claimed the 1 lane would cause traffic, especially during the summer months, as Cemetery Street is a main road connecting to Calf Pasture Beach. In addition to the lane reduction on Cemetery Street, the plan calls for requiring the northbound traffic on Gregory Boulevard to now yield to northbound traffic from Cemetery. East Norwalk Association, Neighborhood Association, wrote on their GoFundMe page. The impacts of these changes alone will surely create congestion and gridlock in the height of summer beach season, plus the boat show, fireworks, dog show, car shows, and concerts and charity events, all of which draw regional crowds. Moving now to the next Norwalk Hour story. Consultant. Norwalk expected to maintain AAA bond rating despite concerns over its $435 million debt. Byline Catherine Lucci, Dateline Norwalk. With $435 million of approved city debt, Norwalk residents have expressed concern over the city's debt services and bond rating in the context of large projects such as the new Norwalk High School. Municipal credit ratings are a measure of credit risk, which is another way of saying what is the likelihood of the issuer to pay its obligation to repay the loans, the bonds, said Bill Lindsay, a consultant from Unistat, during a presentation to Norwalk's Board of Estimate and Taxation on Tuesday night. That measure of credit risk is at a point in time, and it's subject to change based on changing credit conditions. So it's important to keep in mind that the city historically maintains a certain credit rating that's not guaranteed going forward. As of June 30th, 2024, Norwalk will have an outstanding debt load of $435 million. However, Lindsay said that with the city's long history of fiscal stability, he believes the bond rating would remain good. The city is paying down significant amounts of debt, so as it brings on new debt issuance, we're not going to be getting to this debt capacity. For 23 years, Norwalk has received the highest bond rating of AAA from all three major credit rating agencies. With large multi-million dollar projects such as the new Norwalk High School and the South Norwalk School beginning, some residents and members of the BET expressed concern that Norwalk could slip from its prestigious rating. Lindsay outlined the, quote, potential impacts from the credit perspective, end quote, of Norwalk's current and future debt standing, factoring in how these projects will be bonded. Norwalk will receive 80% state reimbursement for the new high school and 60% for the new South Norwalk school. However, there is often a delay in the reimbursements for which the city must be prepared, Lindsay said. In the end, Norwalk will be responsible for $47.8 million of the $239 million high school. Lindsay explained that while the school projects won't be allocated under one capital budget but across multiple years, the city is still projected to be under its debt capacity. Based on fiscal year 2023 results, Lindsay projects the city's debt capacity to be $650 million. Currently, the city has $155 million, quote, authorized but unissued debt, end quote, which includes the two new schools. With the city's history of paying back debt and its overall fiscal strength, Lindsay was optimistic Norwalk would maintain its AAA bond rating. This year, Norwalk allocated $42.5 million to the debt services line and approved a capital budget of $45.3 million. The three bond rating agencies have their own methodology in grading cities, with the Moody's rating as the most competitive. I think the important takeaway here is you don't need to score AAA in every single metric, Lindsay said. If we've got metrics that are weaker, as long as we've got offsetting stronger metrics, right, that should be enough to help bring the overall rating up to the level that we're looking for. Considering economy, financial performance, institutional framework, and leverage, debt accounts for only 10% of their entire scorecard Moody uses, Lindsay said. Norwalk's new chief financial officer, Jared Schmidt, said he would be looking for grants for the city to apply for to ease the amount of bonds the city needs to take out. Moving now to the front page article on the Stanford Advocate. $5 million cut from Stanford budget. Byline Brianna Garciulo, Dateline Stanford. The combined operating budget for the city and Stanford schools is more than $5 million smaller as it heads to the Board of Representatives for potentially more cuts. The Board of Finance reduced the Board of Education side of the budget by $3 million Tuesday night, despite three members supporting a larger cut of $5 million. The Finance Board also made about $2.15 million in cuts to the city side of the budget. Superintendent Tamu Lucero requested $333.7 million for the fiscal year that starts July 1st, which would have been a 6.4% increase from the adopted budget for the current year. Meanwhile, Mayor Caroline Simmons asked for $341.7 million for the city government, a 5.9% increase. adding in $4.9 million in city support services for schools and a contingency reserve of $5 million, the proposed total was $685.4 million, an overall increase of 5.5%. With the Board of Finance's cuts, the increase for schools now stands at 5.5%. The city government increase is at 5.2%, and the overall increase is 4.7%. The board has yet to set revenue levels, which will factor into the tax increase. As the board debated the size of the cut it should make to the education budget, Republican member Dennis Mahoney pointed out that half of Chair Richard Friedman's proposed $3 million reduction consisted of what are known as, quote, free cuts, end quote. Those free cuts are simply changes or modifications based on updated information, Mahoney said. Specifically, they included new projections and assumptions related to health insurance. All we're proposing in Friedman's motion is to cut $1.5 million, which from my perspective is an extraordinarily low amount of money when you're looking at a $330 million plus budget, Mahoney said. Mahoney and fellow Republican J.R. McMullen called for cutting the budget by $5 million, with the $1.5 million in adjustments included. Mahoney said that the $3.5 million portion of the cut would decrease the proposed school's budget by 1%. I think we need to have the courage to send the Board of Ed a message, not in any sort of negative or mean-spirited way, but that they need to sharpen their pencils and they need to focus in on being more collaborative with this board and try to seek out those reductions over the course of the next year, Mahoney said. Democrat Mary Lou Rinaldi, citing the district's flat overall enrollment in the last decade, joined Mahoney and McMullen in voting for the bigger cut. But Democrats Jeff Alzwanger, Laura Berwick, and Friedman voted against it. Without the support from at least four members, the proposed cut failed. School officials have said that a $12.5 million cut to the Board of Education's budget in 2020 drove the proposed increase for the coming fiscal year. The district was able to retain many positions despite that cut by funding them through federal COVID-19 relief money, but those dollars will dry up at the end of this school year, creating a, quote, fiscal cliff, end quote. To save positions, school officials move them over to the operating budget. Officials have also said that increases in bus transportation costs and in the number of special education students and English language learners are factors in the growing budget. They did incorporate some cuts in the budget proposal, including eliminating 44 teacher positions. In a statement Wednesday, Lucero said the budget as amended by the Board of Finance, quote, will enable us to continue providing the quality programs and services that our students need to achieve their academic potential, end quote. She urged the Board of Representatives to approve the budget without any further cuts. On the city side, the Board of Finance made a $250,000 cut to the $48 million proposed budget for the police department, and a cut of the same amount to the fire department's $47.9 million budget. It also cut $142,554 in funding for new emergency management director position, with members saying that current staff could fulfill the role. The board cut funding to hire a construction manager for a project to build two new schools in the Cove. Members said the position should be added after the projects to build a new West Hill High School and a new Roxbury School are further along. The $128,147 cut was to a line that would have funded the construction manager's salary. Rinaldi unsuccessfully proposed eliminating an existing position in the city controller's office called Divisional Finance Manager, a role she described as redundant and unnecessary. The budget includes $156,015 in funding for the manager's salary. Friedman said that Director of Administration Ben Barnes asked the board to keep the position in place to support the city's new controller. The largest single cut to the city side was $731,973 reduction to reflect an updated assumption for employee health insurance. Among other cuts, the board also reduced proposed increases in funding for liberation programs in Inspirica, New Covenant Center, and the Multicultural Council, and zeroed out new proposed funding for the Police Athletic League, Silver Source, a Boys and Girls Club camp program, Building One Community, and Jewish Family Services. As for Simmons' proposed $66.1 million capital budget, the Board of Finance made $5.4 million in cuts, some of which the mayor said were unfortunate. While I am supportive of cuts to reduce the tax burden on residents, I am disappointed by some of the cuts made to the capital budget for our administration's key priorities, including the installation of solar infrastructure, sidewalk renovations, and affordable housing projects, Simmons said in a statement Wednesday. Simmons had proposed allocating $750,000 to the Housing Development Fund, but Board of Finance members said they needed the nonprofit to provide more details about its plans. The board also cut Simmons' $500,000 request to continue studying the idea of building a public safety complex at the site where the old police headquarters once stood on Bedford Street. I just don't see how we're going to undertake a project of this magnitude, given all the capital spending that we're putting into the schools, Friedman said. Moving now to the next front page article on the Stanford Advocate. New Canaan bans flags that aren't town, state, or U.S. on town property. Quote, we are a member of this country and this state and this community, end quote. Byline Molly Hirsch, Dateline New Canaan. Following in the footsteps of neighboring communities, New Canaan officials adopted a policy to limit which flags can fly on town property. On Tuesday morning, the New Canaan Board of Selectmen approved a policy to fly only the U.S., Connecticut, and New Canaan flags at municipal properties. The town's policy does not include Board of Education properties. First Selectman Diona Carlson said she wanted to bring the policy forward after she was approached during her first week in office about flying, quote, another country's liberation flag, end quote. Carlson said she strongly believed the only flags that should be represented on town government property were those representing the country, state, and town, to avoid having the government make calls about which flags get to fly when. I don't want anybody to feel like I don't support their cause when they ask me to fly a flag, Carlson said. It shouldn't be anything about my or any of our personal opinions about any issues. Our flagpole should not be a speech mechanism. It is a recognition that we are a member of this country and this state and this community. Flag policies have become a growing trend in cities and towns across the country, many triggered by a U.S. Supreme Court ruling that the city of Boston violated the First Amendment by rejecting an application to fly a Christian flag. New Canaan's three-flag policy is similar to the one approved in the neighboring town of Darien, which Carlson specifically referenced during the meeting. Town policies like Enfield's allow POW/MIA flags, while Greenwich's approved a policy that continues to allow community flags to fly on town property. Flag policies, including Darien and Enfield's policies, have come under criticism from LGBTQ+ advocates and some state officials for prohibiting the pride flag. While Carson initially proposed a mechanism to consider flying military flags, Selectman Amy Murphy Carroll suggested limiting to just the three to, quote, keep it really tight to New Canaan, end quote. Carroll said she had nothing against flying flags to honor the military, saying members of the military would be represented by the American flag. If you have kind of a just tight policy, then we're not picking one person's interest over somebody else's interest and dividing people, she said. Selectman Steve Carl agreed with Carroll on limiting the policy to the three flags, saying as a community, New Canaan does, quote, an excellent job recognizing the military, end quote. We have the plaques downstairs. Guards Acre is another spot that has a flagpole where we could say, hey, that's the appropriate spot for recognitions of military, Carl said. Keeping it tight, that's what this draft and the idea behind the policy is. Moving now to a front page article in the New York Times. Colleges warn of punishment for disruptions, setting limits as Gaza protests spread. Byline Jeremy W. Peters. The 100-year-old annual honors convocation at the University of Michigan is typically a decorous affair with a pipe organ accompanying golf clap applause. This year's event was anything but. Protesters rose from their seats and unfurled banners with, quote, Free Palestine, end quote, written in red paint. They shouted, quote, You are funding genocide, end quote. Unable to continue with the ceremony, university officials cut it short as hundreds of disappointed students and their parents stood up and walked out. 2 days after the honors convocation, the university's president, Santa J. Ono, issued a stern rebuke. Enough. Like many of you, I am proud of our university's history of protest, he said, but none of us should be proud of what happened on Sunday. He announced that the school would draft a new policy to redefine what could be punished as disruptive behavior. The University of Michigan is not alone. After years of often loose enforcement of their own rules, some of the country's most high-profile academic institutions are getting bolder, suspending and in some cases expelling students. The Massachusetts Institute of Technology, New York University, and Brown University have recently taken swift and decisive action against student protesters, including making arrests. And on Thursday, Columbia University hit its limit with student protesters who had set up dozens of tents on campus, sending in the New York Police Department to make arrests. The arrests followed congressional testimony on Wednesday, in which the president of Columbia, Nemat Shafik, said the school had delivered an unambiguous message to students that misconduct would not be tolerated. College officials are driven by criticism from alumni, donors, and Republican lawmakers, but in interviews they also described the gnawing sense that civility on campus has broken down. They say that lately, some student protests have become so disruptive that they not only are interfering with their ability to provide an education, but they also have left many students, particularly Jewish ones, fearing for their safety. Recalibrating isn't necessarily easy, as many universities are learning. Efforts by administrators to claw back some of their authority over campus demonstrations are being met with pushback from students, faculty, and civil liberties groups who say a university's role is to foster debate, even if it's messy, rude, and disruptive, not attempt to smother it. Campus activists say the aggressive enforcement of the student disciplinary process by universities is a new and concerning development. This is an escalation, said Rosie Fitzgerald of the Institute for Middle East Understanding, a nonprofit that is tracking how schools are responding to student demonstrators. Suspensions and expulsions, quote, didn't used to be a tactic, end quote, she said, but now we're seeing that as an immediate response. In her congressional testimony, Dr. Shafik revealed that 15 Columbia students had been suspended in recent weeks. She also said the school had, for the first time in 50 years, made the decision to ask the NYPD to assist with protests. Vanderbilt University issued what are believed to be the first student expulsions over protests related to the Israel-Hamas conflict. More than two dozen demonstrators stormed the university president's office, injuring a security guard and shattering a window, and occupied it for more than 20 hours. Vanderbilt suspended every student involved in the demonstration. Three were expelled. Student protests have a history of being disruptive and occasionally violent, from the Vietnam War era to today. Since Donald J. Trump's election in 2016, many campuses have become especially volatile places, seeing an increase in angry demonstrations over conservative speakers, some of whom have been disinvited out of fear for their safety. The October 7th Hamas attack on Israel has sparked another wave of protests, which university administrators and free speech advocates say poses new challenges. In interviews, they described encountering students who were unwilling to engage with administrators when invited to do so, quick to use aggressive and sometimes physical forms of expression, and often wore masks to conceal their identities. When I talk to my fellow university presidents, everybody has the same experience, said Daniel Diermeier, the chancellor of Vanderbilt. He said that experience typically involves confrontations with a small group of students, several dozen or so, who are uncompromising. They're not interested in dialogue. When they are invited for dialogue, they do not participate, Dr. Diermeier said. They're interested in protesting disruption. That's different, he added. At Pomona College in Southern California, seven students were suspended this month after a group of demonstrators forced their way into the president's office to protest the removal of an, quote, apartheid wall, end quote, in support of Palestinians. School leadership described the incident as part of a troubling pattern in which students wearing masks that covered their faces set up tents on parts of the campus in violation of Pomona policy, harassed staff and visitors on campus tours, and then refused to identify themselves when asked. It was impossible for college officials to tell whether they were even engaging with actual Pomona students, let alone have an open conversation, said Tracy Awari, Assistant Vice President for Student Affairs at Pomona. In the same way we think about anonymity in internet communications, it's really hard to have an argument if you don't know who you're arguing with, Ms. Hawari said. But as colleges consider how to rein in the protests, they risk overreaching. The last 6 months have really tested the principles that govern speech on campus, said Suzanne Nussel, Chief Executive of PEN America, a writer's group that focuses on supporting free expression. On one hand, schools need to have room to set rules, but Ms. Nussel said there is this tension between wanting to enforce the rules and also acknowledging that college is a learning environment. You want people to be able to make mistakes without facing lifelong consequences, because if you're too heavy-handed, it can reinforce this sense of grievance. Students who have been subject to tough disciplinary measures have said they found the process disorienting and sudden. At Vanderbilt, the students who were suspended were barred from campus, unable to stay in their dorm rooms, according to Esri Tyler, a sophomore gender studies major who participated in the sit-in at the president's office. Students were panicked and very confused, Ms. Tyler said, adding that the school's procedures seem designed to, quote, very purposely deny students due process, end quote. She said that her suspension was lifted and that she is now on probation for 15 months. Dr. Diermeier said that the school had to draw a line somewhere. This has nothing to do with free speech. That's a red herring, he said, adding that no one has a right to harass. But as colleges and universities take a harder line, they are running into resistance from students, faculty, and outside civil liberties groups that say they are stifling the very kind of expressive freedom academia purports to cherish. Michigan's draft policy on disruptive conduct, for instance, has been criticized by the Michigan chapter of the American Civil Liberties Union as too vague and broad for disallowing activity like impeding the flow of foot traffic on campus and interrupting lectures or performances. Of course, universities have a legitimate interest in prohibiting the kinds of major disruptions that completely shut down official events or make it physically impossible for speakers to communicate their message, said Dan Korobkin, legal director of ACLU Michigan. But, he added, they cannot demand complete passivity from everyone who sets foot on campus. A University of Michigan spokeswoman, Colleen Mastoni, said, our goal with the draft disruptive activity policy was to make policies clearer in short key terms well-defined. The university has solicited feedback on the draft, and Dr. Ono said in a recent letter to students and faculty that he would not, quote, rush the development of this new policy. We will ensure all voices have an opportunity to be heard, end quote. At Vanderbilt, Dr. Diermeier has established an initiative, The Future of Free Speech, to promote free expression beyond college campuses. Jacob McHanagama, the head of that program, said in an interview that he had expressed his differences with Dr. Diermeier over the way the student occupation of the president's office was handled, including when the police arrested a reporter for a local publication who was covering the event. But, he added, The willingness of some students to push the limits of tolerable conduct necessitates a response from educators. It's the job of professors to say, here are the red lines, Mr. McCanagama said, and that's one of the issues that's plaguing universities around the country. Moving now to the companion article. Police arrest dozens of Columbia students at Gaza protest. Bylines Sharon Otterman and Alan Blinder. More than 100 students were arrested on Thursday after Columbia University called in the police to empty an encampment of pro-Palestinian demonstrators, fulfilling a vow to Congress by the school's president that she was prepared to punish people for unauthorized protests. I took this extraordinary step because there are extraordinary circumstances, the president, Nimat Shafik, wrote in a campus-wide email on Thursday afternoon. The president's decision swiftly sharpened tensions on campus, which has been battered for months by boisterous pro-Palestinian demonstrators that many Jewish people regarded as anti-Semitic. And it stood to become a milestone for the country as campuses have been torn by the Israel-Hamas war and grappled with how to manage protests. What was far less clear was whether the harsher tactics would form an updated playbook for officials struggling to calm restive campuses or do little besides infuriate and inflame. Protesters had already promised that any effort to dismantle the encampment would only embolden them. Dr. Shafik's message arrived as swarms of New York City police officers clad in riot gear and bearing zip ties marched on the encampment of about 50 tents that had sprung up earlier in the week. On Thursday, protesters clutched Palestinian flags, demonstrators sat huddled on the ground, and a thicket of onlookers kept watch as officers bore down on tents in the zone that had styled itself as the, quote, Gaza Solidarity Encampment, end quote. Since you have refused to disperse, you will now be placed under arrest for trespassing, a man repeatedly called through a loudspeaker. The protesters responded with their own repeated cry, Columbia, Columbia, you will see, Palestine will be free. Mayor Eric Adams said on Thursday evening that while Columbia has a, quote, proud history of protest, end quote, students did not, quote, have a right to violate university policies and disrupt learning, end quote. Less than an hour later, at least two buses were filled with arrested protesters, while other demonstrators thundered their displeasure toward officers. Among those arrested, according to police, was Isra Hirsi, the daughter of Representative Ilhan Omar, Democrat from Minnesota. Ms. Hirsi was issued a summons for trespassing. They can threaten us all they want with the police, but at the end of the day, it's only going to lead to more mobilization. Maryam Alwan, a senior and pro-Palestinian organizer on campus, had said before the arrests. Barnard College, across the street from Columbia and so closely linked that the two institutions share dining halls, said it had begun issuing interim suspensions against its students who participated in the encampment. Now and always, we prioritize our students' learning and living in an inclusive environment free from harassment, Barnard said in its own campus message. Given the evolving circumstances at Columbia and in the area, we are working to ensure the safety and well-being of the entire Barnard community. The core of the turmoil, though, was at Columbia. Etched into Columbia's history is the brutal police crackdown that its administrators authorized in 1968 against student protesters who were occupying academic buildings. The fallout from the violence tarnished the school's reputation and led it to adopt reforms in favor of student activism. Now the university points proudly to that activism as one of the hallmarks of its culture and markets it to prospective students. On Thursday, Dr. Shafik insisted that university officials, quote, work hard to balance the rights of students to express political views with the need to protect other students from rhetoric that amounts to harassment and discrimination, end quote. In recent months, she and administrators across the country have felt the tension acutely as the government opened investigations into the handling of bias claims at dozens of schools, Congress subpoenaed records, and court dockets filled with lawsuits. Columbia, with roughly 5,000 Jewish students and a vibrant strain of support for the Palestinian cause, has drawn particular attention, which led to the appearances by Dr. Shafiq and three other Colombia leaders on Capitol Hill on Wednesday. During her testimony, Dr. Shafiq said she had been frustrated, quote, that Colombia's policies and structures were sometimes unable to meet the moment, end quote, and said the university had updated many of them. Some of those changes include limiting protests to certain times of day and to designated spots on campus. Colombia's tightened rules were being tested even as Dr. Shafiq testified. By 7:15 p.m. on Wednesday, Colombia said the university had issued a written warning to students in the encampment. They had 105 minutes to leave or face suspension. Administrators also deployed intermediaries to try to defuse the showdown, only, they said, to have those entreaties rejected. In a statement before the arrests, Apartheid Divest, a coalition of student groups, said that protesters planned to remain until the university acceded to its demands, including that the university cut its financial ties to Israel. And while Dr. Shafiq's decision drew immediate criticism from the protesters and their allies, others on and around Columbia's campus had signaled that they would support a crackdown. They have guidelines, and if they are violating them, I don't see why this is a special circumstance, said Amy Nelson, a student. Since the October 7th Hamas attacks on Israel, administrators at Columbia had tried to calibrate their approaches to the demonstrations, balancing free speech rights with the security of Jewish students. But before the Republican-led House Committee on Education and the workforce on Wednesday, Dr. Shafiq and other Columbia leaders signaled a tougher approach. The co-chair of the university's board, Claire Shipman, declared that there was, quote, a moral crisis on our campus, end quote. And Dr. Shafiq went so far as to detail some of the disciplinary actions underway, including suspensions and firings. That conciliatory approach toward House Republicans infuriated many on campus. In New York, some students and faculty members complained that university leaders had largely kowtowed to a Congress whose insistent questioning helped fuel the recent resignations by the presidents of Harvard, and the University of Pennsylvania. 5 days after the attack on Israel, hundreds of protesters gathered on the campus and the university shut its gates, a step that has now become familiar as protests have flared. Weeks later, Columbia suspended a pair of student groups, Students for Justice in Palestine and Jewish Voice for Peace, in connection with an unauthorized student walkout. The university rolled out a protest policy in February that was designed to curtail demonstrations, and this month, Dr. Shafiq announced suspensions of students who had helped organize an event that included open expressions of support for Hamas. This is a challenging moment, and these are steps that I deeply regret having to take, Dr. Shafiq wrote on Thursday. Tents were removed later that day, but within hours, another protest had formed on the lawn, and new tents were up. Today's death notices from Stanford in the Stanford Advocate, Joseph Zinicola. There were no death notices in today's edition of the Norwalk Hour. Moving now to the business section in the New York Times. For first time in 2024, rates for mortgages hit 7%. Byline J. Edward Moreno. Mortgage rates rose above 7% for the first time this year, crossing a symbolically concerning threshold that threatens to keep millions of potential home buyers and sellers on the sidelines of a U.S. housing market that is increasingly showing signs of slowing. The average rate on 30-year mortgages, the most popular home loan in the United States, rose to 7.1% this week, Freddie Mac reported on Thursday, the highest since November. Mortgage rates reached a recent high of nearly 8% late last year, a level not seen since 2000. As mortgage rates have risen in recent months, making home ownership costlier for buyers, potential sellers who may feel locked into lower rates on their existing loans have been keeping their houses off the market, in effect pushing prices higher too. Combined, the forces have fed into a broader feeling of frustration about the economy at a time when inflation has remained hotter than expected. Potential homebuyers are deciding whether to buy before rates rise even more or hold off in hopes of decreases later in the year, Sam Cotter, Freddie Mac's chief economist, said in a statement. It remains unclear how many homebuyers can withstand increasing rates in the future. At the same time, the market has slowed. Sales of existing homes fell by 4.3% in March and 3.7% from a year earlier, according to the National Association of Realtors. In April 2021, mortgage rates were at about 3%, less than half the current rate. They began to climb that year and continued to rise in 2022, when the Federal Reserve started raising its benchmark rate in an effort to combat inflation. Although inflation has since cooled significantly, it's still above the central bank's 2% target. The Fed has signaled in recent months that it may keep the cost of borrowing higher for longer amid stubborn inflation. The Fed's benchmark interest rate is currently the highest it's been in 22 years. Mortgage lenders generally watch the 10-year Treasury bond, which are tied to mortgage rates, and expectations that the Fed will keep rates high has pushed up Treasury yields. The 10-year Treasury yield has soared since the start of the year, now sitting at about 4.6%. The NAR agreed to settle litigation last month that would eliminate the standard sales commission, a move housing experts say could bring down home prices. Sellers currently pay a 5 or 6% commission to a real estate agent, a cost that's typically passed on to the buyer through a higher sticker price. Moving now to the next article in the Stanford Advocate. Siberian Husky gets closer to becoming Connecticut State Dog. Byline John Moritz, Dateline Hartford. The University of Connecticut Huskies may be champions of college basketball, but the Siberian Husky is the king of Connecticut. Almost. As members of the NCAA champion men's basketball team mingled about the state capitol on Wednesday, lawmakers took the first step to officially designate the Husky as the state dog of Connecticut, joining the pantheon of state symbols that includes the mountain laurel, sperm whales, and Revolutionary War hero Nathan Hale. The legislation, HB 5304, passed the House by a vote of 128-18, and now heads to the Senate. Among the concerns raised by the opponents of the bill were the time spent debating a trivial topic, as well as the non-American origins of the Husky breed. Like many of Connecticut's state symbols, the bill began as a push by elementary school students in Fairfield several years ago to designate an official state candy. Lawmakers landed on the lollipop for that spot this year, beating out a push by proponents of the orange-based Pez brand, and added the popular Huskies for good measure. Joining the push for the legislation was UConn's mascot Jonathan the 15th, himself a purebred Canadian-born Siberian Husky, who delivered, quote, forceful, articulate, and excellent, end quote, testimony to a legislative committee last month, said State Representative Matt Blumenthal, Democrat from Stanford. It was extraordinarily compelling, Blumenthal joked. Even more compelling, most recently, was the excellent performance of both the men's and women's basketball teams for the University of Connecticut. A last-minute amendment added to the bill on Wednesday would establish a working group to examine the future of one of Connecticut's more controversial symbols, the invasive predatory praying mantis that serves as the official state insect. The working group will include at least two students who have expressed an interest in alternative candidates for the mantis's title, the spring azure butterfly and autumn meadowhawk dragonfly. The group will submit its final report to the legislature early next year. Moving now to the next article in the Norwalk Hour. Case to be dropped in Norwalk Hospital doctor's kidnapping after he left Brooklyn Mirage. Byline Peter Yankowski, Dateline Stanford. A New York man accused of kidnapping a Norwalk Hospital doctor after he left an event at the Brooklyn Mirage concert venue last year is expected to have the case against him nullified on Friday. Anthony Benjamin, 44, of Bronx, New York, is scheduled to appear Friday in State Superior Court in Stamford. He's been free on a promise to appear in court since shortly after his arrest on July 23, 2023. Benjamin is facing charges of second-degree kidnapping with a firearm, a felony, and misdemeanor possession of a controlled substance. But the prosecution is expected to drop the case when he appears in court on Friday. Prosecutors have already entered a nolle, dropping the case against Benjamin's co-defendant, Stephen Daly. Assistant State's Attorney Joseph Valdez explained at the time that the doctor, quote, does not want to cooperate, end quote, with prosecutors. Valdez says the case cannot move forward without his cooperation. He said the case against Benjamin will also be nulled when Benjamin next appears in court. Under a null, the prosecution has 13 months to reopen the case. If they decide not to proceed, the charges are dismissed at the end of the 13-month period. Benjamin and Daly were accused of kidnapping the doctor, an ophthalmologist, after he left an event at the Brooklyn Mirage on July 21st last year. Police eventually arrested Benjamin and Daly while they were in the parking lot of Norwalk Hospital on the morning of July 23, 2023. The doctor told investigators he was kidnapped by Benjamin, who took him around the Bronx on a shopping spree, as well as stops at a barbershop and strip club, according to the police report. The doctor told police he finally convinced Benjamin to take him to Norwalk Hospital after he faked an urgent call, the report said. He told police Benjamin called Daly to drive because the doctor's car was a manual, the report said. The doctor told Benjamin did not display a weapon, but said he was, quote, packing, end quote, as he touched his waistband, the report stated. Benjamin also claimed he, quote, put people in body bags before, end quote, and threatened to kill him, quote, but he would then smile and laugh at him, end quote, according to the report. Daly was charged with conspiracy to commit second-degree kidnapping before his case was dropped by prosecutors. Police also found cocaine in the vehicle, which led to Benjamin's drug possession charge. Authorities initially held Benjamin on $1 million bond. However, Supervisory Assistant State's Attorney Michelle Manning told the judge that, without independent corroboration of the doctor's story, she didn't feel right asking for a high bond, according to a transcript of the hearing. New York police have also investigated whether the doctor's kidnapping was connected with the disappearance of the other two men who went missing after attending events at the Brooklyn Mirage. Carl Clemente and John Kastick, both 27, were found floating in Newtown Creek, which sits less than a mile from the venue on Stewart Avenue. Clemente was last seen around 10 p.m. on June 11, 2023, outside the Mirage. He was found dead days later in the creek. Kastick disappeared from the Mirage about a week after the events described by the Norwalk doctor. He vanished from the Mirage around 3 a.m. on July 29, 2023, and his body was found in the creek on August 1st. Moving now to the next article in both the Norwalk Hour and the Stamford Advocate. They once had a secret handshake. Now these Connecticut men have a cannabis production facility. Byline Jordan Nathaniel Fenster. Brian Fay and Art Linares have known each other for a long time. Fay was the operating partner at Lenny and Joe's Fishtail, a well-known New Haven restaurant that fell victim to the pandemic. His business partner in that venture was Linares' father. I used to babysit him, Faye said of Linares. I used to call him my best friend and we had a secret handshake, Linares said. Both Faye and Linares, a former Connecticut state legislator who is married to Stamford Mayor Caroline Simmons, have worked in real estate for most of their careers. The two are now founders and owners of Rodeo Cannabis, which consists of a 250,000-square-foot outdoor cannabis farm and a cannabis production facility. A bit of cannabis is real estate, getting the local permits and approvals, Linares said. To run the production facility, Faye and Linares turned to Alex Knight Hernandez. He's now their vice president of operations, but he was kitchen manager at Lenny and Joe's, and was a State Department of Correction employee working at the Bridgeport Correctional Center as a kitchen supervisor doing, quote, a lot of large-scale food production handling, end quote. A couple thousand gummies isn't that far off, he said. When we were opening this place, I told Art I got the perfect guy, Faye said. It took me a while to get him out of corrections. The production facility is so new that during a recent tour, employees were churning out the very first vape cartridge and gummies in hopes of getting them on shelves by April 20th. Though they do have plans to expand into other methods of production, for now, Rodeo is specializing in what's referred to as, quote, live rosin, end quote, a chemical-free process often considered a superior cannabis product, as it uses no solvents in the extraction process. Linares and Fay said that they believe theirs is the only facility dedicated to producing live rosin consistently. Right now, customers have to drive to Massachusetts to get rosin, Linares said. The cannabis is harvested and then flash frozen at their farm and shipped across the state to the Sterling facility in 5-pound blocks. They're planting now and hope to harvest 50,000 pounds of cannabis come harvest time. The flower, as it's called, is then washed in a near-freezing bath that agitates the plant material so the tiny hairs, called trichomes, where the majority of the THC resides, come free. The washing machine, called a hashitron, turns out a pale, foamy slurry which is freeze-dried to become a sand-like substance known as bubble hash. That bubble hash is pressed to exude thick, sticky, pure THC, which is then melted and decarboxylated the hash oil. The oil is what then you can infuse into edibles, Knight Hernandez said. That's what you're seeing in vape carts. That's your usable intermediary product. The hash oil is irradiated to remove any microbes and injected into vape cartridges or mixed into cannabis edibles. For every 5,000 pounds of cannabis biomass, they are able to produce about 3,200 grams of usable oil, a little more than 7 pounds. The vault at Rodeo will slowly get filled, but for now it's largely empty housing, only the company's very first products coming off the line. Those first products will be offered to any and all legal dispensaries that wish to carry them. The feedback so far has been very positive, especially with the live rosin, Linares said. They've all reached out and they're excited to get their hands on the product. Rodeo has applied for zoning approval to open a dispensary in Shelton. So far, local zoning officials have been reluctant to move forward on the application, but Linares is confident. We've invested $14 million between the sun-grown farm, the $3 million license fee, this lab, and all the operating expenditures, he said. We expect to do well with this business, and when we're able to open up Shelton, it will only improve. Connecticut currently has only 6 licensed cannabis growers actually putting products on shelves, but more are in the pipeline, which means the landscape may change. In Massachusetts, which has no statewide caps on the number of available licenses, the price of cannabis has plummeted. We're getting job applications from folks in Massachusetts because companies either closed or they're not happy there, Linares said. In Massachusetts, people are really struggling while we're seeing equipment being fire sold and we're seeing people looking for work here. Faye and Linares are hoping to carve themselves a niche in the Connecticut cannabis marketplace, serving as a processing facility, particularly due to their focus on a solventless process. We invested heavily in this manufacturing lab so that we can help other growers process their flower, Linares said. They'll also sell cannabis wholesale to other licensed producers who don't have their own cultivation facilities. The processing facility is new, but the farm itself has already churned out 30,000 pounds of cannabis. We plan on doing that consistently, so any other small food and beverage or small manufacturer that's looking for biomass to process themselves will sell them fresh fresh frozen products as well, including even the big guys, Linares said. Well, that's all the time we have today. It's Friday, April 19th, 2024. My name's Harold Topper, and I've been reading from today's editions of the New York Times, both newspaper and online, the Norwalk Hour, and the Stanford Advocate. Please stay safe.